Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Well, the headline today is Congress returns from recess, include a long laundry list of big issues that will have impact on everyday Americans as well as ripple all the way across the world. They all have to be tackled in a hurry. But beyond the headlines and the politics of it all, it's time to think again about the hard work and heavy lifting of governing. Speaker of the House Mike Johnson and Utah Representative Celeste Malloy join us. Let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day? Think again with Boyd Matheson on KSL News Radio.
Well, it used to be said that you would campaign in poetry and then you have to govern in prose. Sadly, I think a lot of what we see around the performative politics of our day is that people campaign in anger and then govern in grievance. And that prevents a lot of the real work from being done when it comes to how do you make the best decisions to move the country forward. We're really pleased to have joining us on the program today Speaker of the House Mike Johnson from Louisiana and Utah's Congressional Representative Celeste Malloy. Welcome to both of you.
Hey, Boyd, great to be with you.
Mr. Speaker, let me start with you in terms of the focus. Obviously, a lot of things coming as we come back from a recess. But I want to start with just a process piece, because one of the things you had to get done before you left town for recess was just the simple funding of the government. Just walk us through the governing portion of that, not the politics and the showmanship stuff that we saw. How did you approach that in terms of some of those crucial decisions?
Yeah, thanks, Boyd. Great question. You know, we have to face reality right now. We're in an unprecedented moment in the United States Congress. We literally are operating right now with the smallest majority in the history of the Congress. We have a one-vote margin. That means if we want to move, Celeste and I, conservatives, we're here in the Congress working with our colleagues, if we want to move legislation that is our preference, that advances all of our policies, we can only lose one vote in the House. And then the problem is, even if we pass the House, of course, the Senate is run by Chuck Schumer and the Democrats, and we know who's sitting in the White House. So we only have one-third of one-half of the federal government, and it's the smallest majority in history. So here's the thing. We have to be realistic. Ronald Reagan taught us a long time ago, I'd rather get 70 or 80% of what I want than go over the cliff with a flag waving. And when it came to funding the government, we really had a binary choice. We either get the best possible product we can in this hopelessly divided government right now, or we just shut the government down. And the problem is, if you shut the government down, it really begins to hurt the American people very quickly, because they start missing paychecks and flights, and the border sectors get unpatrolled, and troops aren't being paid and all the rest. And then we're really concerned that that would affect our ability to keep and grow the House majority. So not a lot of fun right here. You do sometimes the best that you can, and that's what we're trying to forge every single day.
Yeah, and Representative Malloy, as you had the opportunity to go through that in your early days since taking that seat there in the 2nd Congressional District, give us your perspective of how you watched that play out.
Yeah, I've only served in this really small majority. We don't have easy days right now. Speaker Johnson's the only speaker I've worked with as a member of Congress. But I want to point out too, you know, the speaker talked about going into a shutdown, and I spent time in Utah since I took that vote. And a lot of people have said, why are you scared of a shutdown? What's wrong with a shutdown? And it's worth noting that voting no also has consequences. If we go into a government shutdown, not only do people start to miss paychecks and get panicky and the markets get a little weird, but shutdowns only work if you have a united front and you say, we're going to shut down the government until we get X, Y, and Z. You can't do that when you have a one-vote majority and you don't all stand shoulder to shoulder in that small majority. And unless you've been living under a rock somewhere, you've probably noticed that we're not doing that very well right now. So going into a shutdown wouldn't put us into a strong bargaining position.
Yeah, no question. And it is one of those interesting moments of a narrow majority and a deep divide in terms of governing philosophy, both Democrats and Republicans, but also within the Republicans and within the Democrats, for that matter, on a wide range of issues. Speaker Johnson, as you've been in that perch, I think the message you delivered in your first address after taking the gavel, I think, was really instructive in terms of a governing philosophy. Just share that a little bit for the folks who may not have been paying attention as closely when you took the gavel.
Yeah, that's a great point, Boyd. Look, we we are in a battle right now that's not even really Republicans versus Democrats. And I think if anybody's really paying attention, they'll understand we're down to the root issue now. What we're doing, Celeste Malloy is representing Utah's 2nd District so well because she is a governing conservative. She comes in here, she believes what I do, that what Ronald Reagan said, I quote him all the time because he was so spot on. He said, you know, at the end of his career, he said, they call me the great communicator, but I really wasn't. I was communicating great things. They're the same great things that have guided us since our nation's founding. We're trying to preserve those things. The principles like individual freedom and limited government and the rule of law and peace through strength and fiscal responsibility, free markets, human dignity. I mean, these are the things that made America the greatest nation in the history of the world. And right now, they are imperiled because there is another group of people, a crop of liberal progressives who are coming up even into the Congress, and they're trying to dismantle those foundations. They want to replace them. Boy, they want us to be some sort of European-style socialist utopia. And all of us know, and all your listeners know, that is a dangerous fool's errand. And so Celeste and I and our colleagues are in here every day. We're not just fighting for, like, the Republican Party platform. It's that. But it's so much more. We're trying to defend the core principles, the founding principles of this nation. And that's what's at stake. And that's why keeping and growing the majority is so very important. And every day we put the axe to the grind and we try to move that incrementally up the field as far as we can.
Yeah, and that incrementalism, I think, is the hard thing. I think in the social media age where everyone wants the it's sort of like Major League Baseball. Everyone wants to hit a home run every time or usually end up striking out in the process. But Representative Malloy, as you've been traveling the district, as you've been in that seat now, give us a sense in terms of what you're hearing from voters and what message they want you to take back to Speaker Johnson and your colleagues in Washington.
Yeah, as I'm talking to voters, they're feeling a lot of frustration. There's a lot of confusing, you know, politics going on, and I think people are tired of having to pay attention to politics. They want us to do something good and definitive and put the nation on the right course so that they could go back to paying attention to other things. And so it's tricky right now because people are frustrated, but they want us to give them some optimism. They want us to show up and say, we have a plan. We've got this under control. We're going to take care of it. And to underline what the speaker just said, I just got back from Israel yesterday, and the people of Israel are concerned that we don't believe in our own system anymore. They don't feel like they have the rock-solid relationship with us that we used to have. They used to be sure that we would defend freedom and justice and the rule of law and peace in the world, and we're not projecting that very well right now. So I think the same thing that our voters need from us, the rest of the world needs from us. They need us to be a governing majority. They need us to be low drama and keep moving this ship in the right direction. We're not going to fix everything overnight, but everything we do has to be a step towards fixing it.
Yeah, low drama would be a great move. We always like those people who are high yield, low maintenance. And I think we could use a little bit of that coming out of Congress. Speaker Johnson, you've dealt with a lot of the things that we see coming out of Washington in your time as Speaker, a lot of the fake fights and false choices. And so often we do that in the context of things that are actually compatible principles. And whether it's on the border where we can have compassion and rule of law, I know coming up this week you're going to be dealing with the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, which has one of those interesting compatible principles that people like to divide out in terms of intelligence agencies being able to do their job and citizens being able to have their privacy and their rights. Give us a sense of where we are on that and how you see that moving forward.
Yeah, great point. Look, my background's in constitutional law, and I was a liberty defender, literally, in the courts. I did that for 20 years, and then I was the chairman of the Subcommittee on the Constitution and Limited Government here in the Congress. And so I look at that from that lens. We have got to jealously guard the privacy of the American people, their data online and their phone messages and all the rest. And what happened is over the last several years, some rogue agents at the FBI abused that law, the FISA law, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. It's supposed to be to keep track of known terrorists overseas, right? To make sure they're not plotting something on the homeland. And it's a very, very important effective tool for that. But when the FBI abuses that and they use it to spy on Americans, it's absolutely unconscionable. So we all got together. There's actually some bipartisan, what a concept. It's so alarming that we have bipartisan agreement on 56 major reforms to the FISA law. And to your point, Boyd, it's a great one. We have to balance the protection of liberty and the protection of the physical safety of the American people. We can do that, but it takes a lot of precision, and I think we're going to accomplish that in this new bill.
Representative Malloy, give us your perspective as you go into what will be a really interesting debate, both in what happens committee-wise and then ultimately what gets to the floor.
Yeah, this is an issue that I've been working on every day since I got here. I used to work for Chris Stewart, and he was really involved in this. He helped draft a lot of what became this bill. And so I think the voters in the second district are more keyed into this than the average American is. And it's gotten to the point where when I run into any of my colleagues in the hall who are on either judiciary or intel, they're like, I know. Blessed, we have to reform FISA. I know that's what you're going to come talk to me about. so I'm excited to see how this plays out this week, because we're there. We're going to actually be voting on the base bill and then amendments, and then hopefully final passage if we can get good amendments in there. So this feels like a huge accomplishment for my scant 4 months that I've had here.
All right. And Speaker Johnson, before we let you go, we know it's a very busy day in our nation's capital. We appreciate you carving out some time. Give us just one more thing in terms of the role on the world stage. Obviously, we've got some things coming up with Ukraine and support there, Israel, and then you can just kind of expand that out through the rest of the world, Taiwan and so on. Give us some perspective of what we should be thinking about, not what we should be politicking about, but what we should be thinking about in terms of the principles that should guide our decisions in those areas.
Yeah, look, we have to keep our focus on the main things. That, as I noted earlier, you know, the guiding principles are what are going to get this through this. One of those guiding principles is maintaining peace through strength. And just frankly, everybody understands right now we're projecting quite the opposite. I mean, this president is projecting weakness on the world stage, and that's why everything is such a tinderbox. That's why our adversaries are acting so provocatively. It's why we've got now hot wars in two critical areas of the globe, and we have got to get back on top. As so many times over the last many decades, since World War II, the perception of a strong America, Boyd, is what has kept the terrorists and tyrants at bay. And we have got to restore that strength, because it's essential not only for us, for our liberty and opportunity and security, but for everybody, all free people around the world. We need America to be strong, and a good America is good for the whole country. That is our true north.
Fantastic. And then finally, Representative Malloy, as you wrap up and take a look here, what's the one thing you hope Utah citizens are thinking about as you look at all of these big issues that are on your plate back there in D.C.?
My biggest hope for our constituents in Utah is that they're thinking that there's still a bright future for America. We're taking a lot of tough votes. We're dealing with a lot of messy issues. It's easy to get caught up in the issue of the day, and they're really important issues every day. But my biggest hope is that as we're working through all this, people are still looking towards the future, planning on America being strong in the future, planning on America being a superpower in the future, but most importantly, planning on us continuing to be that shining city on a hill, that beacon of hope for the rest of the world, because we actually believe in our own system. We really truly believe in freedom and limited government and setting an example for the rest of the world. They're still looking to us, and I hope we still believe in it.
Yeah, so important. Speaker of the House Mike Johnson, Representative Celeste Malloy from Utah's 2nd Congressional District, thanks to both of you for making some time on a busy day in Washington, D.C., and we know focus precedes success, especially in Washington, and we wish you good luck as you go through a very busy, very distracted week, but one that hopefully will lead to some good policy that will lead to some good results for the American people. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Boyd.
We'll be right back.
Think again on Inside Sources with Boyd Matheson.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Well, if you didn't wake up this morning thinking about the Chevron doctrine, we don't blame you. But it is an important standard that was set back in 1984 Supreme Court case, and it's had a big impact on all of our lives, whether we realize it or not. And so we want to unpack it just a little bit. It is before the court once again. It is something that has really been the benchmark for a long time and giving the regulatory agencies a lot of power in terms of policy making. And we're going to look at what the current court is looking at. If it reverses it, then what? And helping us do all of that, as always, Kevin Kosar, Senior Fellow with the American Enterprise Institute, where he focuses on Congress, the administrative state, American politics, and election reform. And Kevin, welcome back to the show.
Boy, glad to be here.
For our friends who didn't wake up thinking about the Chevron Doctrine today, give us a little primer there in terms of what it is and what it means, the impact it's actually had on us, whether we knew it or not.
Well, all right. So in our system, Congress writes the laws, and the executive branch is supposed to implement them. Inevitably, laws are not sufficiently specific to handle all kind of aspects of implementation, so agencies kind of figure it out on their own. And in some cases, they issue regulations. Now, the question comes up, how do you know when a regulation is legal, that it is faithful to the law that was passed by Congress? Well, you know, you can file a lawsuit, but then that leaves the courts to figure it out. So what happened back in the 80s? We had the famous Supreme Court Chevron decision, wherein the courts basically said, look, we don't want to be a venue for every case under the sun. If we look at a regulation, we're going to ask ourselves, is it contrary to the law? And if the law doesn't speak on it, is the agency's regulation a reasonable interpretation of the law? Mm. So that's Chevron deference. Very abstruse, but it's had the long-term effect of basically empowering executive agencies to issue the regulations they want and to be less subject to challenge than they might.
Yeah. And so for a real practical tactical, we often use the example of sometimes Congress uses this as a way to not be as accountable. They'll do things like pass the law that says we shall have clean air, and then they bequeath all the power to decide what clean air is and what the rules are and what the penalties are and how to enforce the penalties over to the EPA. And then if a constituent has a problem because it's impacting their life or their family or their business, and they go to their member of Congress and complain, hey, this is hurting us, they'll say, hey, I just voted for clean air. If you have a problem, go to the EPA. And the EPA may or may not be interested because they're not elected. And so there's nothing there. And then usually what happens is what you described, a lawsuit gets filed, works its way through the court, ultimately ending up at the Supreme Court. And that's why that becomes so political. And so walk us through now, Kevin, in terms of what the court is looking at and why they're looking at this again now. And if they do reverse this, what do we expect to see in the aftermath?
Well, yeah, this has been coming a long time. You know, Chevron was a case that was supported by the right. You know, Chevron basically kind of limits courts' breadth of discretion for how they think about the legality of a regulation. But over time, you know, more conservatives have gotten concerned with the fact that the executive branch under Chevron has kind of been able to really push its authority, often in ways that seem to go beyond the clear intent of the law. And the case that brought up this kind of challenge is the Loper case, L-O-P-E-R, which involves fishermen who have basically been told by the government that you have to pay for federal inspectors to come on your boats. And what the fishermen basically said is, look, the 1970s era law that you guys are basing this regulation on, it doesn't say that you're authorized to do that. Mm. It doesn't say that we, the fishermen, have to pay for our own policing in the form of federal inspectors. And so they challenged it. And with a much more conservative court than we had, say, 10 or 20 years ago, the court took the case and is very seriously thinking about where's the line between lawmaking and execution, which is important to our separation of power system.
Yeah, and I think that's such an interesting one. And maybe just unpack a little more on the fisherman there, because that's such an interesting thing, because it went from just having everyone wants to make sure that things are clean and healthy and following the rules and the laws and all of that. But then when it goes beyond that to where they're telling really that you have to hire employees, that becomes a very different matter.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, we agree on the policy goal, but if Congress is not specific enough about the means that are acceptable, don't be surprised when, you know, executive agencies or in some cases even a president will go beyond means that were ever contemplated by the people who wrote the law.
Yeah, and I think that becomes the interesting thing. And I think this is one of the areas where we have to expect more out of Congress. We can't have these, again, lovely sounding laws with great names and titles, but large chunks of it that says we hereby bequeath all of this to the agency. I think we have to get past that. And so how do we get past that? I know you and your colleague, Philip Wallach, who we've had on this show before, have been doing some things to try to change the dynamic of that. Explain that for us.
Yeah, yeah. So if you go back 50 years, the executive branch back then under Lyndon Baines Johnson and later Richard Nixon, they were basically running circles around Congress when it came to budgeting. Mm. They had, you know, an office of budgeting, which later became the Office of Management and Budget. They had all the numbers. They had all the data. They had all the smart people working for them. And Congress didn't have a whole lot. So Congress created a Congressional Budget Office so it could at least have some numbers and it could check the numbers that the executive branch was given it. We looked at that instance and said, you know what? Congress needs the same thing for regulation. More and more lawmaking in this country gets done through regulation than through Congress writing laws. And Congress has hardly any capacity to oversee the executive branch, to know when it's going beyond the law and when it's adopting regulations that are neither legal nor sensible. So we've argued for the creation of a Congressional Regulation Office, a kind of Madisonian response to strengthen Congress vis-a-vis the executive branch. Because, you know, it works, Boyd. Power abhors a vacuum. And if Congress isn't going to wield it, another branch will.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And as you pointed out recently, that knowledge is power. And if you don't want to have unaccountable bureaucrats and judges doing the legislative authority, then Congress has got to both have the weapons, the tools, and the knowledge to be able to actually do their job. And they have to also have the will, I think, to do their job so they can be held accountable as well. Kevin Kosar, Senior Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, great insight, great piece around the Chevron Doctrine. We'll see how that continues to play out as the court unfolds. Kevin, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, sir.
All right, it's Kevin Kosar, Senior Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. And this is one of those things that, again, I know you didn't wake up this morning wondering about the Chevron Doctrine, but it impacts you every day more than you know when we have those who aren't elected making the rules or the laws and the legislation. That's not their job. Their job is to enforce it and implement it. Congress has to do their job, and then the executive branch can do theirs. We'll step aside. We'll be right back with more Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Hear elevated conversation on crucial issues. Boyd Matheson on Inside Sources.
Well, the battle between Hamas and Israel, the conflict inside of Gaza, of course, has caused ripple throughout the Middle East. The U.S., of course, continuing to defend and back Israel as an ally. And, of course, that has riled a few of the other groups, particularly groups like the Houthis, the Yemen-based group that has sabotaged multiple international trade routes, as well as a number of attacks since October the 7th against American troops and our allies. And in response to that, President Biden has responded in kind, greenlighting a lot of different attacks and airstrikes, keeping the Houthis at bay. And then the question becomes, okay, where does that presidential authority limit end, and where does Congress have to begin in terms of something that gets to that level? And it is one that we have to look at often and regularly, and one that I think has been ignored by Democrats and Republicans for a very long time. And someone who's got their eye on this specifically, someone we always turn to, Fiona Harrigan, associate editor at Reason, and has a great piece on this today. Are the strikes on the Houthis constitutional? And again, regardless of how you feel about all the other pieces, this is an important constitutional question. And Fiona, welcome back to the program. So give us your sense first, just in terms of what has been taking place since the October 7th attack and what's been going on with the Houthis in particular and what the U.S. response has been.
Right. So as you mentioned, for several months now, the U.S. and its allies have been conducting strikes against the Houthis, which are an Islamist militant organization based in Yemen. It's been attacking commercial ships in the Red Sea, disrupting one of the world's most important shipping routes. And the Houthis claim that these attacks are a gesture of support for Hamas and its war against Israel. In turn, Joe Biden notified Congress of these airstrikes, notified Congress that these attacks would be happening. But very importantly, he didn't ask for authorization. And he said he was doing this to protect American citizens and the free flow of international commerce. But it's really important to mention that Congress has the full power delegated by the Constitution to declare war. And his not asking for authorization is something that's really peeved several lawmakers. There's a coalition that wrote this letter in January saying no president, regardless of political party, has the constitutional authority to bypass Congress on matters of war, that robust debate is necessary before these actions should be carried out. And it's raised a lot of questions about the president's war-making abilities and whether war powers have gone too far for the president.
Yeah, and so let's unpack that just a little bit. You reference, of course, Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. That is why Congress has that particular authority. Walk us through, we've had this thing really back since 1973, the War Powers Resolution. Kind of walk us through how we've gotten to this point and how that's evolved over time.
Right. And it's important to mention that according to that constitutionally delegated authority, Congress has issued its last declaration of war officially. It was over 80 years ago during World War II. So it's been a long time since we've really abided by the standard that was outlined by the Constitution. Since then, there have been a number of kind of piecemeal authorizations and piecemeal legislation authorized by Congress to give the president more authority to act unilaterally. Some of that comes through the 1973 War Powers Resolution, which Biden cited to justify these strikes against the Houthis. That requires that presidents notify Congress of any military action within 48 hours. But it does have a high burden of proof, essentially. It requires that there be a national emergency where the U.S. is under imminent attack. And these lawmakers who wrote this critical letter in January say, no, that's not the situation we were in with the Houthis. It might be horrible and disruptive, but it wasn't as urgent or as imminent as you would have us believe. And then following that, there have also been these authorizations for the use of military force. And these are kind of what give the president the most power in modern war making. Right. So we have the 2001 AUMF, which was passed in the wake of the September 11th attacks to give the president the authority to use, quote, all necessary and appropriate force against parties involved in those attacks. And that is obviously very, very broad phrasing. And it's been used broadly as well, over 40 operations in over 19 countries. Mm. So it's super broad, and it negates Congress's role in war making, and it takes a lot of the debate that we would expect to see before these huge events out of the hands of lawmakers and away from the people.
Yeah, I think that's such an important part of that is, one, I always get nervous when they put in things emergency, because mm-hmm. we've so lost. I'm not even sure what an emergency is anymore, because it can be anything. It's a great excuse for Congress to spend money, for presidents to use vast swaths of executive power. And so we seem to be continuing to expand what that actually is. I think, as you pointed out, some of these may not have been emergency, but talk to us for a minute about why it's so crucial that Congress actually debate and declare these kinds of actions of war.
Well, it allows people to hold their lawmakers much more directly accountable, right? If these lawmakers are answering to constituents, it's much more direct as opposed to the president unilaterally acting. It's also a much more public form of debate. You know, Congress people will have to put their records on the line to defend a conflict and you know, so reap the consequences of unpopular decisions. So that kind of debate and that kind of exchange, I think, is just critical. And it's something that can really, it's a way to avoid entrenching the U.S. in conflicts that don't have attainable goals or incredibly relevant goals to the national interest. We can say that these things are emergencies or that they're important for the national interest, but it's another thing entirely to put American lives on the line and American tax dollars and everything that comes with these conflicts that get authorized without much thought.
Yeah, no question about that. We were talking in our previous segment about the Chevron doctrine, which also has the same kind of problem. Is if there's no transparency and there's no accountability to lawmakers, things are done very differently. And I think the same is true when it comes to these war powers, that if there isn't that open transparency, if there isn't a real debate in front of the American people, then no one gets held accountable in the end, and we just kind of keep trudging along. What should we be looking for moving forward? Is there any kind of traction or any kind of conversations in terms of changing the game when it comes to these kind of actions, again, regardless of who's in the White House and who's in control?
Right. You know, every couple of years, every year it seems there are legislative efforts, often very interesting coalitions of progressives and constitutional conservatives and libertarian-leaning lawmakers to repeal these AUMFs and to essentially roll back presidential war powers. But they never get over the finish line for various reasons, one of which is that the president is never quick to give up power, which is unsurprising. You know, President Joe Biden has said that he would support repealing a 2002 AUMF because, quote, it would likely have minimal impact on current military operations. So even when they do support these efforts, it's not for reasons of smaller government or reducing presidential war powers. So interesting to see whether any of that will change in the next couple of years, whether those arguments will strike a chord. But I'm not incredibly optimistic so far.
Yeah, so interesting. And this is another one of those things that, again, I don't think a lot of people woke up this morning thinking about, but it's one that we all need to think again about, because this is how we get to better governance and better results, whether it's dealing with a conflict half a world away or things that are happening right here in our own backyard. Fiona Harrigan, always appreciate your writing, your thinking on all of this. Fiona's the associate editor at Reason, a great writer, great thinker, and I always appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you so much.
All right, that's Fiona Harrigan once again from Reason, reason.com. You can check out all of her work there. And these are important things that we've been talking about in hour number one of the show today. Of course, we kicked it off with Speaker of the House Mike Johnson, along with Celeste Molloy from the 2nd Congressional District, talking about how do we do things and how do we do it a little bit better. And then looking at everything from the Chevron Doctrine, what's the power of the agencies, to what's the power of Congress when it comes to war, and the power of the president when it comes to taking action. All of those things are things that we've got to think again about as we move it forward. We'll be back with hour number two coming up next on Inside Sources. Stick around.
KSL FM Midvale.
KSL Salt Lake City.
From the KSL Common Spirit Health Studios, this is KSL News Radio,
Utah's news, traffic, and weather station.
Get deeper insights on the news from inside sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. It's great to be with you today. As always, I am Boyd Matheson, and we're going to go into the deep dive of the law of unintended consequences in some interesting spaces that will actually impact you. Could Congress be taking a swipe at your credit card reward points? And is some of the action by the Federal Reserve and by Congress, as well-intentioned as it may sound, as good a bumper sticker as it may be, is it going to end up hurting you in the end? Someone who understands this better than anybody I know, Eric Boehm, is a reporter at Reason. And Eric, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Boyd, glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
All right. So this is one of those things where you say, now, wait a minute. The president in his State of the Union address has been pounding the pulpit and the podium a lot in terms of what he was going to do to get rid of things like junk fees and airline fees and all of these things. And some of these sound great, and they're good campaign slogans. But when you start playing them out, the results are not always quite as good as it sounds.
Yeah, that's right. We've heard a lot from President Biden over the last couple of years, you know, on and off about this war on junk fees. One of the, actual things that the administration has done in that conflict, if you will, is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau last month acted to put a cap on credit card late fees. So going forward, credit cards won't be able to charge people more than $8 a month in late fees. The administration says that's basically what it costs to, you know, go through the process of collecting, collecting and processing and handling late payments. So the credit card companies get that, but they will no longer get to profit off of people. And so late fees have been capped with, you know, so it's a much lower level, $8 a month, down from about $32 per month on average is where they were before. And this sounds great. I think, you know, obviously nobody likes paying late fees. I hate it when I forget to make a payment on my credit card and I get dinged with one. But economists say that the consequence of this is going to be probably higher interest rates for everybody, you know, marginally higher interest rates for everybody, just to offset that amount, and possibly, you know, harder to get credit for some people, people who have maybe don't have a good credit history or have no credit history, riskier, you know, people who are a greater risk from the credit card company's perspective. They may have a harder time getting access to credit cards because, you know, they're just not going to be as willing to take a risk on somebody like that. So puts credit out of reach for some people, means all the rest of us pay a little bit more. You know, that's the way these trade-offs always work. You don't hear about that side of it, though, from the White House.
Yeah, there's always a trade-off. That's the I think that's also a law. There's always a trade-off of some sort or another. And so, again, it sounds good. Hey, let's reduce those, no longer have those big $32 late fee payment. And it's only $8. But, again, if you end up paying higher interest rate, if it's harder to get credit, who are we helping and who are we hurting in the end? And you also took on this whole element that got my attention today. It's like, wait a minute, now they're going to come after my reward points? Explain that one to us.
Yeah, that's right. This is a separate thing, but similar, you know, related,
yeah,
issue for sure, because it, yeah, both deals with credit cards. This is something that Congress is talking about doing. So, I mean, I guess I should say, just to close the loop on the other part of this, the junk fees thing at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, Congress may try to undo that, because there's been a bill now introduced by Senator Tim Scott to use the Congressional Review Act to stop the Financial Protection Bureau from doing that one thing. Meanwhile, while Congress is potentially stopping that, Congress, on the other hand, you've got Senators Dick Durbin and J.D. Vance. That's the Democrat from Illinois, Republican from Ohio. So there's this bipartisan effort to pass a bill that would artificially cap the swipe fees that are charged by credit cards to businesses. So every time you go to a coffee shop or go to a bar and you use your credit card, you get charged the bill, a percentage of that, a few pennies of that transaction come out, and that's the swipe fee that's charged to cover basically the transaction costs for the credit providers. And those swipe fees, you know, they add up because we use our credit cards so much, and they're the things that basically fund any sort of reward program. So whatever it might be, cash back or travel points or whatever you get from your credit card, that's all funded through those swipe fees. There's this bipartisan effort now, though, to limit those, because they say this is, you know, this is an added burden and added cost on consumers and businesses, and that credit card companies are basically just profiting off of, you know, how popular and often their product gets used, which doesn't seem like a bad thing to me, but that's the argument here. So attempting to cap these fees, again, you got the law of unintended consequences here. What's going to end up happening is you're going to end up losing, you know, consumers that like these credit card reward programs are probably going to end up losing out, because those will go away if the money that funds them doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah. You used the example in your piece today with the debit fees, going back to Dodd-Frank. Explain that for us, because I think that's a great example of, hey, here was the great cheering of this is what we're going to do to protect the little guy. And in the end, not so much.
Yeah, that's right. This is what I'm talking about here, these unintended consequences. This is not theoretical. We actually know exactly what's going to happen because we went down this road a decade ago. Dodd-Frank, that was the massive bill, the huge financial regulatory package that was passed in 2010 in the wake of the Great Recession, the financial collapse, all of that. Buried in there was a provision that capped debit card swipe fees. So not credit card, but debit card swipe fees. That's the money that at the time banks were getting off of those swipe fees, and then banks were using that pile of cash to fund a whole bunch of programs that were beneficial for consumers, including things like free checking accounts and all sorts of reward programs, things that don't exist anymore because they were basically done away with by Dodd-Frank. So the great irony here is that when debit card use, the debit card usage has declined as a result of this, because consumers have now flocked towards credit cards because of the rewards programs that credit cards offer that debit cards no longer really can offer because they don't have the financial incentive there to do it. And then credit card swipe fees are frequently actually a higher transaction cost for businesses than the debit card swipe fees ever were. So a provision that was put into this law to protect businesses from being gouged by the banks with these debit card swipe fees actually ended up pushing consumers towards credit cards, which have bigger swipe fees, which means consumers ultimately are, you know, are still paying a fraction of all these transactions. And it means that the businesses are still getting, you know, still getting a hit for those costs at the end of the day, too. So, yeah, I mean, Congress, this is the repeated story, I think, of regulation in Washington, whether it's the federal bureaucracy doing it, whether it's Congress doing it. You know, you can always try to cap one thing or set a price on one thing, but the consequences are always going to be beyond what the policymakers think they are.
Yeah, and I think that's so interesting. You actually pointed to a 2013 study from the University of Chicago that just talked about that in real terms, in terms of what happens and what doesn't get passed on to consumers. Just walk us through that real quick.
Yeah, that's right. There was a couple different studies, actually. A 2013 study by some economists at the University of Chicago found that merchants saved about $7 billion annually from the capping of debit card fees in the Dodd-Frank law. But those savings ended up not actually being passed on to consumers. So rather than the banks getting that extra money, you know, all the businesses that otherwise would have been charged those swipe fees just kept the extra cash. So, you know, consumers didn't really see any benefit there. But on the other hand, that same study found that consumers lost more on the banking side than they gained on the merchant side, meaning that the loss of things like the debit card reward programs, free checking accounts, all of that actually outweighed the supposed benefits that they were going to get from the capping of those fees. Then another more recent study, 2022 study by some researchers at Georgetown and Yale, found that the end of those debit card reward programs, as I was saying, nudged consumers towards using credit cards more often, and that credit cards often have higher swipe fees for businesses than the debit cards ever did. So you end up with the consumers not getting the benefit that they were promised from the law. The businesses just kept the extra cash that they weren't being charged anymore by the transaction costs. And then so the consumers lost out, and then the businesses also lost out because now they're paying higher swipe fees on a different type of transaction. Again, here you've got federal officials meddling in the economy, trying to do something that they say will fix, make consumers and businesses better off. And it looks to me like it actually ended up doing neither of those things.
Exactly. And this is our ultimate lesson in unintended consequences today. You need to go to reason.com, check out both of Eric's pieces, both on the rewards points, the swipe fees, also the late fees, and just how it sounds good on the front end, but you got to watch the back end. That's where the results actually matter. Eric, as always, thanks so much for joining us.
And I guess if I have time, I should add one more thing, Boyd, which is that the mastermind behind that provision, the debit card swipe fee provision in the Dodd-Frank law, was Dick Durbin. It's the same guy.
Who's
sponsoring the bill to do this with credit cards. It's like he literally has not learned the lesson. It's the exact same person behind this.
So now we have
anyway,
the arson.
Thank you so much for your time.
The arsonist is now the firefighter, and that's how Congress continues to go in circles. All right, Eric Boehm, reporter at Reason, as always, best of the best. We'll step aside for bottom of the hour news. More Inside Sources coming up next.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
The presidential election in November promises to be a close one once again. And you can tell by the way the candidates are scrambling and crisscrossing the country and particularly focusing on the swing states. Republicans and Democrats alike are desperate to get their majority to the voting booths and in some cases keep their opponents' supporters away. So how have voting laws changed since the last election? What does that mean for what takes place at the polls, our confidence and trust in the system, and how this will all play out come November, and not just at the top of the ticket with presidential elections, but down ballot races that are so crucial to the country as well? So we want to look at some of the new voting laws in swing states and what that's telling us and how that might shape the 2024 election. Really pleased to have joining us on the program, Patrick Marley, national reporter for The Washington Post, focuses on voting issues, particularly in the upper Midwest. And Patrick, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me here.
So let's dive into this. This is one of those where, depending on where you fall on across the political spectrum, you might find it a little easier or you might find it a little harder to vote this coming election. Tell us what you're seeing in your reporting.
So the first thing to keep in mind is that we've seen a lot of changes to election laws. In 2020, as the pandemic emerged, every state changed its voting laws. They made it easier to vote in some ways. Many states sent absentee ballot applications to all voters. Some states even sent actual absentee ballots to all registered voters. States set up curbside voting programs and expanded vote by mail, had drop boxes. And so you saw this dramatic change to all states' elections. After the 2020 election, every state then made new changes. Some states decided to make those 2020 changes permanent or to further expand their laws that made voting more convenient. And other states went in the other direction and, you know, not only went back to pre-2020 policies, but in some cases put in place new restrictions on early voting or absentee voting. And so what I looked at were the swing states, you know, seven states that are probably going to be determinative of who wins the election. And you see these dramatic differences. Places like Michigan has an expansion of voting opportunities, and places like North Carolina have some new restrictions and new policies that mean some absentee ballots that would have been counted in the past would not be counted in the future.
Yeah, and that's so interesting. And so I thought it was fascinating, your piece in the Post, talking about places like Michigan expanding, North Carolina making it kind of upping the bar there in terms of expectations. What else did you see in that? Where else are you seeing some of those changes and shifts? And is this really just kind of a tale of depends on where you fall on the spectrum?
Well, it does track closely with, you know, the states that have Democratic majorities and Democratic governors made voting, you know, increased opportunities for voting, had more ballot drop boxes, more hours of early voting. States with Republican control tightened their laws, made changes that maybe made it, you know, tightened deadlines for getting in absentee ballots, maybe had fewer polling hours, increased opportunities to challenge a voter's, another voter's ballot or their eligibility to vote. And then in states like Arizona and Wisconsin, where you have mixed control, you know, divided government, a governor of one party and a legislature of another party, you see sort of the same thing that you had seen in the past. You know, the legislature passes something and then the governor vetoes it, or the governor proposes something or tries to do something and the legislators won't go along with it. So in those two states, Wisconsin and Arizona, it's really pretty status quo compared to 2020. And then in a state like Pennsylvania, you see sort of changes that go in both directions. The new governor there implemented automatic voter registration. So anybody who goes to the DMV to get a new license or renew their license gets put on the voter rolls unless they don't want to. They proactively opt out. But at the same time, some changes made to absentee ballots. They have some sort of idiosyncratic rules about handwriting the date that you return your ballot onto an envelope. And a court just ruled that if you fail to do that, you know, which some voters write the wrong date or they don't know they're supposed to write the date, then those ballots will be rejected.
Yeah. As you've gone through this and you really did a great deep dive on this. And again, regardless of Republican, Democrat, left, right, all of that, to me, the interesting question that you get to that I think is the real crucial one in all of this is that balance and having the compatibility of access and integrity. I think those are the real keys to making sure this constitutional republic keeps rolling in terms of free and fair elections. What did you learn or what surprised you in that process of looking at how we balance that access, making it as easy as possible or as convenient as possible, and also upholding those high standards of integrity so we have confidence in the election as well?
Well, I think it is true that you hear from partisans this, you know, one party is talking about one half of the equation and the other party is talking about the other half of the equation. And they sometimes get into some pretty overheated rhetoric about it.
Yeah.
I did talk to one law professor who sort of emphasized the point that really these are popular ideas. If you talk to most average people and you ask them, Do you think everyone who is eligible to vote should have a reasonable opportunity to conveniently vote? They say yes. And then if you ask them, do you think that there should be protections and measures in place to ensure that, you know, voter fraud doesn't exist and that there are some inconveniences like a photo ID law that would ensure greater trust in the system, voters tend to say yes. So the opinions about the voting system don't, I think, always track with the kind of messaging we hear from the, you know, very ideological Republicans and very ideological Democrats as they talk about this stuff.
Yeah, I think that's so important. This often becomes just one more of the fake fights and false choices, because I think these are compatible principles. I think they have to be compatible principles if we're really going to have elections that everyone has confidence in and everyone can participate in. I think, as you said, sometimes in the, even in the polling, the way the polling is set up often gets us to the wrong, maybe gets us to a correct answer, but to the wrong question. As you pulled those apart, I think that's the real key there. Is there anything else that you're watching for in the coming months that might impact some of those critical swing states and some of these new laws that are on the books?
I mean, I think it's also important to, like, put yourself in the shoes of a specific voter. You know, these, we're talking about probably a handful of votes that are, you know, when you change a law, it can seem really monumental, and it is. But really, in terms of whether it's going to affect the outcome, is only going to be the case if it's a very close election. But if it's your vote, if it's your ballot that's not going to be counted, then you may feel differently about it than if you think about it in more abstract terms.
Yeah. Great insight. This is a great piece. You should check this out at the Washington Post. Patrick Marley is the national reporter for the Washington Post, focuses on voting issues, particularly in the upper Midwest. Patrick, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
All right, again, that's Patrick Marley, national reporter for The Washington Post. And this is just one of those that I think is so crucial to the conversation, that we have to get to this idea of compatible principles, that access to the ballot box, that ability to vote, and integrity of the vote, those are compatible principles. And bringing those together is what will make sure we all have confidence in the results of the elections. We'll step aside for one last break. Some final thoughts for Inside Sources coming up next on KSL News Radio. Stick around.
Hear elevated conversation on crucial issues. Boyd Matheson on Inside Sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. It's great to be with you today. As always, I am Boyd Matheson. As we round out the program, if you missed any of the program today, of course, you can always go back and check the podcast, kslpodcast.com. Just click on Inside Sources. And today you're going to want to go back. We started the show today with two special guests joining us live from our nation's capital. We actually had the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, joining us with Celeste Malloy, who represents Utah's 2nd Congressional District. We talked about a wide range of topics in terms of governing and what that actually looks like and how challenging it is in an environment where there is a one-vote majority for the Republicans in the House. And there's a deep division within the Republicans, and there's deep division within the Democrats. And so governing coalitions are hard to come by these days. And so it was very interesting to get the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson's, perspective on that. We also talked about the important things that are coming up. We talked about the past funding in terms of the government, getting those things done. We also talked about FISA, which is this government rule, this way that the intelligence agencies gather information regarding terrorists, potential terrorist threats, national security threats. And often as they're doing that, of course, they're scouring text messages and internet and phone records and so on. And a lot of times some innocent American data gets scooped up in all of that. And so there has to be a way to properly do that to make sure we're protecting the information of United States citizens. One thing to go after a terrorist or a suspected terrorist from another country. Another thing when you're scooping up information in terms of the rules and the rights of American citizens. And so that's going to be an interesting one to watch navigate. It was very fascinating to hear both Speaker Johnson's perspective and Representative Malloy's perspective in terms of how this will move forward. There's some interesting bipartisan coalitions developing around this in terms of some changes to the system to both balance that security and the rights of citizens. And there's also things from both sides that are bipartisan against some of these processes. some from the judiciary, some from the intelligence community. And so it's one of those very complicated things, but it's one that we have to get back to the balance and compatible principles, and that national security and the rights of citizens are compatible principles. And navigating that is Congress's job. And it sounded to me, from what I gathered from both the speaker and from Representative Malloy, that there is going to be a process in terms of getting some of those things to the floor, some of the changes to tighten up some of those things and make those adjustments. We'll see how all of that plays once it gets out of committee. If it gets to the floor of the House of Representatives, we'll see how all of that plays out. So you go back and listen to the podcast. Again, great conversation from our nation's capital today by Speaker of the House Mike Johnson and Representative Celeste Malloy from the 2nd Congressional District here in the state of Utah. We also had some really interesting back and forth as we looked at some of the challenges that we face in the country when it comes to things with unintended consequences. Everything from overreach from presidents of both parties when it comes to war powers. We talked about some of the things that are going on in terms of the Chevron doctrine, which is really this thing that gives agencies, have given them a lot of control and power over the years, and clawing some of those things back. So there's more transparency and more accountability. And the same thing is true, whether it's an agency making rules, which really are law, and the penalties, the consequences that come with them, that really is Congress's job, or a president from either political party taking action militarily, and when does that need to go through Congress? Article 1, Section 8 is pretty clear that those powers are vested in the Congress. And the most important part of that is to make sure that we have these debates in front of the American people so that we can hold our elected representatives accountable. Because if we can't do that, then we got bigger problems. And that's where a lot of these things really begin to unravel. So we took a good look at all of those things during the course of the program today. I want to round out and kind of go back to yesterday just a little bit. I was so fascinated with how fascinated the world was, and Americans in particular, with the eclipse yesterday. And it is one of those rare moments where you get everybody looking up and getting some perspective in terms of what's going on. We talked yesterday about this principle of the cosmic perspective. And we talked about this whole idea that the cosmic perspective is actually humility, that when you actually understand your place in the universe, everything changes. It changes the way you approach misunderstandings and disagreements. It changes the way you react to people who disagree with you politically or on issues that you care about at work or at home. It just puts everything into perspective. And so I think if we look at that cosmic perspective, beginning with humility, humility solves a lot of our challenges and problems. And so it reminded me, as we were looking at the eclipse coverage yesterday, which was just everywhere, and all of those who took trips to go to just the right spot so they could see that eclipse in totality, and again, getting this cosmic humble perspective. And it reminded me of a conversation I had a few years ago with Mark Roosevelt, who is the president of St. John's College, very different kind of college. It's a small liberal arts college. It has campuses in Annapolis, Maryland, and Santa Fe, New Mexico. And it's really one of those interesting laboratories of learning. They don't have professors who stand at the front of the room and profess things. Everybody sits around and it's all about questions. And when I asked him why it was so successful, he said it really was about this whole idea of humility, because that's the most important thing that they want their students to learn is humility. And I remember asking him that question. Here he was, this university, this college professor or president, saying the thing he wants every graduate to walk away with is humility. You know, could humility really be the ultimate takeaway from 4 years of study? But the more I listened to him, the more I realized that learning, real learning, can't take place without humility. And then I went even further, thought, well, you know what, neither can understanding or compromise or even compassion. None of that can happen without humility. So I think humility is not only the the antidote to what I like to call the axis of arrogance in our society, which is around instant certainty and tolerant zealotry and elitist egotism. We have to get past all of that. And the way you do that is with humility. And the eclipse was a nice reminder for us yesterday of where we are in the universe. And it might help us just treat each other as fellow travelers here on this planet just a little bit better. We can learn more from each other, and we can solve our problems together just a little bit better. Well, that wraps it up for us on Inside Sources today here on KSL News Radio. Thanks for joining us. And as always, as you go out in the world today, make sure you see something that inspires, say something that uplifts, and do something that makes a difference.
KSL FM Midvale.
KSL Salt Lake City.
From the KSL Common Spirit Health Studios, this is KSL News Radio.
Utah's news, traffic, and weather station.